As we heard last week, there is quite a bit of scientific research being done to develop the use of psychedelics and entheogens for therapeutic use. Rick Doblin started MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, in 1986 for this exact purpose. We continue with Rick today. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries.
You know, independent chemists had manufactured MDMA, and Sasha Shulgin had been, since the 60s, devoting himself to developing and understanding consciousness through creating all sorts of new psychedelic drugs. He'd been a star performer for Dow Chemical. He'd invented one of their insecticides. They gave him free rein to run a lab to do whatever he wanted. He started focusing on consciousness, and eventually he decided it was probably better for him to do that outside of Dow. They decided that as well. But he was told by a graduate student about MDMA. He'd been doing molecules similar to it. He manufactured it. He tried it. He felt that it had incredible potential. And he had a small test group of people, 12 people, that he would work with to evaluate new drugs that he would develop. And then this group felt that MDMA had substantial therapeutic potential. And then it went from this small group out to this team of underground psychedelic therapists and psychiatrists, particularly a fellow named Leo Zeff, who's been called the secret chief. And MAPS has published a book that's available on our website, maps.org, about the secret chief and how he led and developed and trained hundreds of psychiatrists and psychologists how to use MDMA and other psychedelics. And so once it was used in this network, then it became more widespread, and some people, as I said, thought, here's an opportunity to turn it into ecstasy and turn it into a public thing. And so it sort of came to public awareness at the time of Nancy Reagan and the rise of the Just Say No. And so the conflict was between sort of these conservative forces of society that really were based in part on suppression of all sorts of different things, and sort of this more open-minded part of the culture that was exploring these limits to our own maturity and spirituality, self-imposed often, our own, you know, struggle with our own, you know, emotional, spiritual selves.
The thing that
it was just that conflict of people looking for growth through these tools that were demonized. And what happened in the 60s is that psychedelics got to be seen as symbols of cultural revolution and cultural change. The Beatles, who were, you know, one of the main exponents of LSD, were also anti-Vietnam War and very much sort of got into Eastern spirituality with meditation and the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and learning transcendental meditation. And a lot of the people who were behind the environmental movement and other social change efforts were inspired by psychedelics. So it became symbolic politics. So it was both conservatives in favor of the status quo, seeing drugs, particularly psychedelic drugs, as challenging that. And then it also fit into the narrative for a lot of people about how these passions, these internal passions and desires, that we really need to suppress them through, you know, society and through all sorts of different kind of religious dogmas, and that then became challenged by people who were using these drugs as well.
Right. And you know, so, it's so interesting that what's it like for that child, for instance, my kids, you know, they were in school in the third grade approximately 20, 25 years ago. So beginning with the public institutions of education, it gets very confusing because in the third grade, they're asked to join the DARE or Just Say No to Drugs Club. And by the time they're in high school, most of their lives, most of the adults they've grown up around are on some kind of prescription drug altering them. And then most of the great authors they're being asked to read in high school altered their states in order to write this brilliant work.
Yeah, it's completely mixed messages that we're giving these kids.
Right.
And by the time they get into high school and college, you know, they don't believe what they've been taught in the DARE program, because the DARE program, you know, both of my, I have three children, a son 16 and a daughter 14 and another daughter 12, and they all went through the DARE program. And my youngest daughter is in sixth grade now. And in fifth grade, the DARE teacher told her, and this was like unbelievably outrageous, he was saying, and DARE teachers are police officers, so we should say that it's police officers going into school, and they're not scientists, they've got a political agenda, but this particular police officer told my daughter's class that it's bad to be addicted to anything, but if you had to choose between being addicted to tobacco and being addicted to marijuana, you should choose being addicted to tobacco, because marijuana was a long, slow death. It's completely flipped around.
Yes.
What's really the case.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we have this sort of schizophrenic reaction in our society, and kids are rightfully confused by it.
Right.
And it's just really, you know, when you develop policies that are fear-based, and even the National Institute on Drug Abuse, you know, which I've said we've sued because they haven't wanted to sell us marijuana. They have a monopoly on the control of marijuana for research, and we've wanted to look at marijuana for medical uses through the FDA, which has been willing to put science before politics. But we've got a situation where there's this kind of active suppression of new science by NIDA, and that they've put out all of these, you know, excessive fear-based, you know, NIDA even supported this researcher, George Cardi at Johns Hopkins, that ended up claiming that, you know, MDMA would hurt the dopamine system and cause Parkinson's. And that was completely in contradiction to all the prior research. And it ended up that this was published in Science, the leading, you know, journal in the world in this way. And they had to retract it because it turned out he mistakenly gave MDMA and methamphetamine. He mixed up the bottles somehow, and he was giving these animals methamphetamine when he thought it was MDMA.
Right. Well,
and yet, it was obvious that it wasn't true to many of the people who had studied the literature, but NIDA made it into a big deal.
Well, of course, yes. I mean, in defense of science, I've worked a lot in my life with alternative therapies, and, you know, Sloan Kettering, for instance, in the huge cancer hospital in New York, for years they were guilty of finding a drug that they wanted to legalize. And if they had to use two or three different scientists to find the goodness about it, they would do that so they could go make their millions on it. So science is slow to change. We can only hope that things will move a little more quickly here as we go along. But let's talk about MAPS and what you're doing. I know your work with the FDA is most important to you, and you've certainly made a huge amount of headway. So bravo to you, Rick Doblin, for getting all of this done. It's really quite amazing to hear more and more about it. And as you mentioned already, you've been doing quite a bit of work with the stress syndrome. There's also work going on, isn't there, with people that are dying? Like, it's fairly known to those that know about Aldous Huxley. He asked for LSD on his deathbed. And,
yes, he did.
And so people that are suffering from very traumatic diseases, especially at the point of being very close to death, these things can certainly alleviate some of that. And does that become a moral question to you? Maybe you can start with some things you've seen with studies, and then, you know, does it become a moral question of, well, maybe we should really bite the bullet and learn how to do it without a drug of any kind?
Well, let me say that this question about biting the bullet, learning how to do it without a drug, that it's like if you break your leg, it's okay to get a cast and use a crutch, but the goal is to try to be able to walk without it. So I would say that the use of drugs and therapy is not to it's not like your classic pharmaceutical company for-profit model, where the model is, hey, we're going to give you a drug, but you're going to need it for the rest of your life, and you're going to have to take it three times a day.
And that'll be 2 days.
Yeah, it's so with psychedelics, it's the opposite. It's like we're trying, exactly as you said, to help people do it without the drug. But we feel that there's this intermediate stage where the drug can be extraordinarily and often uniquely useful. So I think most people sort of opposed, let's do it without drugs, or, you know, we can use drugs. But I think if you can see drugs as a vehicle temporarily to help improve people's non-drug state, that in MDMA therapy for post-traumatic stress disorder, it's about a four-month process of therapy, and people get MDMA on 3 days, once a month apart. But that's it. And at the end of the therapy, we're saying, all right, out you go. You know, you don't get a prescription for MDMA to take home.
Right. And I'm so glad you're saying that, because people have a misconception about that as well.
Yeah, because we talk about drugs, and they're just used to the pharmaceutical company model, which is, here, take this every day and take it on your own. So we're talking about psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy, with the emphasis being on the psychotherapy. And the drug is a catalyst, but we don't say that the drug is in and of itself the therapeutic agent, because the drug is just a tool. And there are people that can take LSD, take psilocybin, and end up a lot worse off, where they're flooded by feelings that they're not supported to experience, that they develop kind of panic reactions. That, you know, it's what I talked about before. If it's too arousing, people don't know how to process it, and they resist it and develop a lot of problems because of that. So there's two main streams of research. One is MDMA for post-traumatic stress disorder, and our study right now in the U.S. is entirely in veterans from Iraq, Afghanistan, and a few from Vietnam. And we're doing this without the full cooperation of the VA. They're aware of what we're doing, but we're recruiting veterans outside of the VA system, and we're hoping that the results will then feed back to the VA to help them decide that this might be something that, in a more systematic way, they want to get involved in looking at. And we have studies in Switzerland, Israel. We're working in Jordan, Canada, to start research. And I was just in Australia, and there's teams there that are interested in working on MDMA for PTSD research. So we're doing international series of small phase 2 pilot studies to get a lot of information to help us in a couple of years design these large-scale phase 3 studies. The other major area of research with psychedelics as part of the psychedelic renaissance is working with people that are dying, that are anxious about dying. And so we've got a study in Switzerland with LSD. It's the first study of the therapeutic use of LSD in about 35 years. And it's the only study right now in the world in which LSD is being given to humans. We started a study at Harvard Medical School with MDMA for cancer patients with anxiety, advanced-stage cancer patients with anxiety. And then the Hefter Research Institute has started research that works with psilocybin to help people who are dying. And there was just a paper published in the leading psychiatric journal, the Archives of General Psychiatry, about a study that was done at UCLA with psilocybin for cancer patients. And there's projects right now at Johns Hopkins with cancer patients, with psilocybin, and also at NYU.
You know, I'm sorry, I just want to interject one thing here. There, obviously, as you're speaking about mushrooms and then peyote, for instance, these are substances that were definitely used by ancient cultures. And is there evidence that they use these during the dying process? Do you know?
Well, I'm not so sure, because they were used in sort of their religious rituals.
Right.
And one would, so that they were more often the historical stories are about rites of passage, rites of initiation, where people are sort of educated in this understanding that it's not all this conscious ego. You know, that we are united with all life, and that there's a deeper unity, and that's kind of the spiritual lesson that people are learning. And yet, you know, specifically in these other cultures, that they combined sort of spirituality and medicine, that they weren't so separate. And so they would be used in all sort of rites of passage, including the dying process. But what we most hear about it is in terms of religious use. So right now, for instance, in the United States, there's 500,000 members of the Native American Church, And they have the legal right to use peyote in their ceremonies.
Yes.
And they will use it when people are, you know, facing different kind of crises. So I think what we're trying to do with this overlay of science is bring these tools that have been used for millennia in different cultures and bring them back to our culture, learning from how they've been used before, but then also modifying them with our understanding of brain sciences and psychology, and to try to make it so that our modern world can incorporate some of the wisdom of the ancient world, but also recognize that the ancient world had, you know, its own limitations in terms of religious dogma, and this is the only way. And
right.
So I think we live at this historically tremendous time with enormous, enormous challenges, but also enormous opportunities. And I think we're likely to be able to make the kind of breakthroughs that are necessary to really lead towards a more peaceful world. I mean, Albert Einstein said something great. He said that the splitting of the atom has changed everything except for our mode of thinking, and hence we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe.
Mm.
And when I think about what he meant about the mode of thinking that hasn't changed, I think it has to do with this spirituality dimension, that people really are still, for the most part, identifying with their race or their gender or their nationality or their religion or their, you know, sexual orientation or any number of these more partial senses of who we are. And if we can shift towards this deeper mystical sense of who we are as part of everything, then, you know, we're not so scared. You know, I'm Jewish, and I've been trying to do a project with MDMA in Jordan in a largely Muslim context. And I really feel that having been there now for about four different times, you know, that the people are people, and that we can have these different symbol systems, but that, you know, we have more in common than we have alike. And so I don't need to feel like there's this, you know, fundamental historical clash between, you know, Judaism and Muslim, but the fundamentalists of the different religions, the Orthodox Jews and the Orthodox Muslims, you know, are at odds with each other, and each of them are making these exclusive claims.
So yes,
I think that the work in particular with the end of life is what will help us to speak to the needs of the larger culture, that these tools, we're all more scared of dying than we are of drugs.
We did start off our first interview last week with ibogaine, and there's so much that's been going on regarding ibogaine and addiction. And there are just wonderful stories of people who have been able to kick addiction because of ibogaine.
Yeah. Ibogaine has what seems to be a pretty unique property in that it helps people who are addicted to opiates go through the withdrawal process in a couple days in a way that is much better than the normal kind of withdrawal process, which can be agonizing.
Yes, and
it does it during an ibogaine experience when people are having profound psychological and spiritual experiences that can help them deal with the causes of this retreat to addiction.
But there must be a chemical aspect, don't you think, or no?
Oh, completely, completely.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is something, you know, that's why there is so much to learn from the study of psychedelics and neurochemistry, neurobiology, neuroanatomy. Everything is just, it's tragic that we're just emerging from a 40-year period where most of this research has been, almost all of it, has been suppressed all over the world. Not just nobody was interested in it, but actively suppressing this research. And I think we can develop from looking more carefully at ibogaine some better tools to help people through withdrawal from addiction. But we also can address the causes. People who are addicted are running from things. They want a reliable escape. And if we can help them deal with their demons, to deal with the things that cause them to run, then there isn't as much of a need to be addicted. And ibogaine has both of those things. It somehow physiologically, chemically helps people through withdrawal from opiates, but it also provides a spiritual, psychological dimension. and that people can then... Most people don't realize that Bill W., one of the founders of AA, took LSD in the 50s. This is after he was sober. And he felt that LSD could play a major role in AA, that a lot of times in AA they talk about how you have to hit bottom and then you can turn your life around. And when people hit bottom, often they've destroyed their families, they've destroyed their careers, they've destroyed their health. And what Bill W. felt, based on his own LSD experience, is that you can help people hit a psychological bottom before they have destroyed, you know, their families, their work, their health, and that the LSD also provides this spiritual experience. So, so much of AA is about a higher power and, you know, aligning yourselves with something that you're connected again. People who are addicted often feel very isolated, and the LSD and spirituality in general can help people feel connected.
Yes,
Ibogaine, we've had a situation where because it's a psychedelic drug, the National Institute on Drug Abuse funded several million dollars worth of animal studies. This is back about 20 years ago. And they ended up refusing to go the next step into human studies. And so it's like a lot of these other drugs we're talking about. They're off patent. There is no monopoly power. The pharmaceutical companies are not interested in it. The government is, because they're often too committed to the drug war, is not willing to fund research into beneficial uses of what they consider drugs of abuse. And
right.
The major healthcare foundations, you know, see it as too controversial, although we hope that's going to be changing. So it falls to small nonprofits. So MAPS is basically a nonprofit psychedelic and medical marijuana pharmaceutical company aiming to develop these drugs into prescription medicines. And we have been making some progress. We're also benefited by the fact that these drugs have been heavily demonized, and because of this demonization, there's been an enormous amount of research onto what's bad with these drugs.
Right, it's like a performer. They say there's no bad press.
Yeah,
any press is good press.
It's like the Aikido strategy, where you use the momentum of your opponent sort of against them, and you turn it back on them. So because there's been all of this research into how bad these drugs are, we can now afford to make them into medicines, whereas prior we couldn't. If someone were to go to Medline, which is the online database of the world's scientific peer-reviewed literature and in medicine and science, and you put in MDMA or ecstasy, there's over 3,500 scientific papers that have been produced at what we estimate is over $300 million. And we're able to just, we've spent, a staff member has worked for years, we've spent about $150,000 to review all of those studies. And so now we don't have to repeat them. It's just incredible. So
how are you supported?
Able in a minor, kind of small nonprofit to develop certain psychedelic drugs, possibly even marijuana if we can break the night of monopoly,
right?
You know, into prescription medicines and then into integrated ways with psychedelic clinics, with opportunities to take it out of the frame that these drugs are inherently countercultural or that they're inherently socially disruptive. And most cultures, you know, in a way, as you pointed out, have used these substances, have integrated them, and we're kind of a cultural anomaly. We've overstressed the intellectual, and I think if we can integrate psychedelics into our culture, it won't be destructive at all. It'll be healing.
Rick, I have two questions, and we have a short amount of time left. How are you supported with MAPS?
Well, through donations, we have about 2,400 members. And we are a 501c3, IRS-approved, nonprofit organization. So rather than investors, because, again, there's no patentable substances that we're really looking at, nor are there use patents, because so much of this has been in the public domain, so that we're doing entirely public-funded research, in putting it in the public domain, and anybody can take what we've done and try to make it faster into a medicine, or they can modify our therapeutic method. Of these 2,400 members, you know, we get most of the money from the top 30.
Right.
You know, and some people give hundreds of thousands of dollars. We've just, I heard yesterday, I was speaking to a lawyer who said that we're about to receive a bequest of $450,000.
Oh, bravo, Rick. Let me ask you this, and this is sort of going off subject or in another direction anyway. Doors of perception. Nothing speaks more to that for me right now than a recent New Mexico study I heard about where there was some substance injected into people and they actually had the very same tangible experience that people who swear they've been abducted by UFOs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that drug was DMT.
Yeah.
And
that's pretty mind-blowing.
5-methoxy-DMT, which is, you know, an even stronger substance.
So is it? Would you say it's possible that people that claim to have had UFO experiences actually just have, because there's some of that substance in us anyway, isn't there?
Well,
and could it
DMT
be a total?
Does naturally occur in the brain.
Right. So could it
I
be?
I would say that there's two separate things. There's the experiences that you have, and then there's the interpretations that you put on them. So I don't think that these experiences are necessarily. I think they're real and valid, and people have these, but the interpretations are again filtered through our own personalities, our own cultural context. So I am very dubious about people having DMT experiences and then saying they, you know, were encountering aliens or, you know, and to think that that's really proof. And in fact, that's totally not proof that they actually did speak to aliens. The important question for me is, what information do they bring back? So that you could have a symbol system that's colored by your personality and your culture, and DMT is a very weird experience, and it's not surprising that people think it's some different sort of intelligence or they're in. But I don't think that that's likely or that it's proof. But you know, I would sort of say it because my focus is therapy. What
Yes.
happens to help people feel better? And if they describe a situation that's like, oh, you know, I encountered this alien, and now, you know, from that, I've developed a whole deeper appreciation for the, you know, life throughout the universe, and that I'm part of all of this, then that's for me more important than the explanation.
Right.
But I think from a scientific point of view, from a philosophical point of view, you know, it's important what the explanation is as well. You know, a lot of people in therapy with psychedelics will have what feels to them like a past life experience. And often that will help them to make progress in this life. But I tend to interpret those as more symbolic. You know, similarly with 5-methoxy-DMT, you know, people have had these experiences that, you know, make them believe in God. And I think that belief part, the explanation part, is something that is more individualistic and isn't necessarily proof, but sometimes people feel so reassured and so certain about things that, I mean, even Carl Jung was asked if he believed in God. He said, "I don't believe in God, I know." And so I think we just have to be careful about this differentiation between the explanation and the experience and what can come from the experience.
A very curious and courageous soul, Rick Doblin. Reach out to him at maps.org. And for any guest information to listen to archives and share resources, it's tributariesradio.org. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.